Chapter 8. It was, indeed, the most glorious coup, the completest thing. The other intelligence service gazed at Sir Joseph with admiration, respect, unspeakable envy, and did their very utmost to gather any scraps of credit that might be lying neglected. A vain attempt, if ever there was one, for Sir Joseph, though a mild and even a benevolent man in ordinary life, and charitable, was perfectly ruthless in the undeclared civil war that is so usually fought with all the outward form of politeness between agencies of this kind, and he gathered every last crumb for his own concerns, his own colleagues and advisers. But so glorious a coup couldn't be exploited to the full without a grave expense of time. And it was long before Dr. Maturin was called before the committee to be told that the Chilean proposals, as they were put forward in his minute of the 17th, had been read with considerable interest, and the preliminary discussions and even the first material preparations could go forward, so long as it was clearly understood that at this stage His Majesty's government was in no way committed to any agreement, that the whole undertaking was to be conducted privately in a vessel that did not form part of the Royal Navy, but only in craft hired for hydrographical purposes by the appropriate authority or authorities, and that any contribution should not exceed 75% of the very, very considerable sum left by Dr. Maturin in South America at the end of his last journey. It was agreed on both sides that this was a merely tentative understanding, one that could be put in motion at the time thought proper by both sides, or that could be relinquished by either on reasonable notice. During this period he was staying at the Grapes, an agreeable, old-fashioned inn, a quiet place in the liberties of the Savoy, where he had a room of his own the whole year round, and where his two goddaughters, Sarah and Emily, lived with his old friend, Mrs. Broad. They were as black could be. He'd brought them from a small Melanesian island, all of whose other inhabitants had died of the smallpox brought by a whaler, and their hair was naturally frizzled. But they gave no sign of being foreign, uneasy or ill at ease, as they ran about the lane or fetched a hackney coach from the Strand. They'd picked up English with extraordinary ease, and very early in their voyage from the Pacific, a long, long voyage with a long, long pause in New South Wales and Peru, they had perceived that it possessed two dialects, one of which, the racier, they spoke on the forecastle, and the other on the quarterdeck. Now they added variations on a third, the right Cockney, as it was spoken from rather above Charing Cross down the river past Billingsgate to the Tower Hamlets, Wapping and beyond. This they picked up mostly in the streets and at their primitive little school in High Timber Street, kept by an ancient, ancient priest, a Lancashire Catholic, who called them thee and thou, and taught reading, writing in a beautiful hand, and arithmetic, and attended by children of every colour, as Mrs. Broad observed, except bright blue. Theirs was a busy life, for they not only learned cooking, particularly pastry, shopping in the city markets with Mrs. Broad, and turning out rooms with almost naval thoroughness with Lucy, but fine sewing too, from Mrs. Broad's widowed sister Martha. Furthermore, they often ran errands for the gentlemen who stayed at the Grapes or fetched a coach. These services were rewarded, and when the rewards reached 3 and 4, the sum exactly calculated for the expedition, they treated Stephen to a pair-oared wherry from their own Savoy steps to the Tower, where they showed him the lions and the other moderately wild beasts kept their time out of mind, and then fed him raspberry tarts from a little booth outside. If you had seen Emily thank the keeper for his explanations and beg him to accept this sixpence, I believe it would have touched your heart, said Stephen by the hall fire at Black's. Perhaps, said Sir Joseph, I have heard that there is good in children. but even a greater example of affectionate attention wouldn't tempt me into the wild adventure of begetting any. I do wish, my dear Stephen, that now you're as rich as a Jew again, you'd take a postchaise like a Christian rather than this vile coach. You'll be huddled in with all and sundry, bumped about in an odious promiscuity, pushed, snored upon all night, suffocated, and then put out at your destination a little before dawn, for God's sake. It's quicker than the mail coach, and I have paid for my ticket. I see you're set upon it. Well, God be with you. We must be away. Charles, a coach for the doctor, if you please. How I wish these bags may all arrive at Dorchester. Pushing one crossly with his foot. At least I shall go to the Golden Cross with you and make sure they're taken aboard. Through Sir Joseph's care, the bags did reach Dorchester and the King's Arms in the thin grey light, the faintly drizzling Saturday morning. The guard put them down, thanked Stephen for his tip, and bawled into the courtyard, "Hey, Joe, show the gent into the coffee room. 3 small trunks and a brown paper parcel." The other inside passengers had been much as Blaine had described them, and one had an unfortunate way of jerking out his legs in his sleep. However, the King's Arms gave Stephen a famous breakfast, smoked trout, eggs and bacon, a delicate small lamb chop. The coffee was more than passable, and humanity returned like a slowly rising tide. "I should like a chaise, if you please, to take me to Woolcombe as soon as I've finished," he said to the waiter. "And I could wish to be shaved." "Directly, sir," said the waiter. "I'll tell the barber to step in, and I believe you'll have a pleasant ride. The day's clearing from the east." So it was. And before the chaise was halfway to Woolcombe, the sun heaved up his brilliant rim above Morley Down. This was very familiar country now, and presently they were running along the side of Simmons Lee. Far over he could make out 3 riders and a man running with them. Far down towards the mere, a woman and 2 children, one of whom he could have sworn was his daughter, if the little figure hadn't been riding astride. But the runner was certainly Padin. "The next on your right," he called to the postboy. "I know it, sir," said the postboy, smiling back at him. "Our Maggie's in service there." He swung the chaise into the forecourt. "The farther wing," said Stephen, since that was where Diana, Clarissa and Bridget lived. He would pay his respects to Sophie later, and to Mrs. Williams in the west wing later still. "Just put these inside the door," he said as he paid the postboy. "The brown paper parcel I shall carry myself." He walked up the stairs and opened the door gently. As he'd expected, Diana was still in bed, pink and sleepy. "Oh, Stephen," she cried, sitting up and opening her arms. "What joy to see you. I was thinking of you not 5 seconds ago." They embraced. She looked at him tenderly. "You're surprisingly well," she said. "Have you had breakfast?" Stephen nodded. "Then take off your clothes and come into my bed. I've countless things to tell you." "Dear me, Stephen," she said, lying back, her black hair wildly astray on the pillow and her blue eyes filled with a splendid light. "I've 1,000 things to tell you, but you've driven them all out of my mind." She stroked the limp arm lying over her bosom for a while and then said, "Tell me, have you just come from the fleet? Are you on leave? Is Jack with you?"
"I am not. I am just come down from London. I've not seen Jack these many weeks. He's still with the blockading squadron."
"Then you don't know that my Aunt Williams came to live here after her friend Mrs. Morris ran off with that odious manservant they had, Briggs." Just then the West Wing was being done up and oh, such quantities of other things, so she was put into Jack's room and there, poking and prying everywhere, she found a box of letters that silly goose Amanda Smith wrote him from Canada, telling him he'd got her with child. And certainly she begged him to go through the motions, you know. These Aunt William seized and ran to Sophie as fast as ever she could and poured out all her bile and methody cant about fornication and so on, working the poor girl up into a frenzy of self-righteousness and jealousy. It had always astonished me that a woman with as much sense as Sophie, and she's no fool, you know, can be so influenced by her mother, who is a fool, a downright great goddamn fool, even where money's concerned, which is saying a great deal. But there it is. Sophie wrote him a letter with all kinds of high-flown Drury Lane stuff, and when the poor fellow came posting up from Plymouth to say he was sorry and should never do it again, she turned him away, clean away. So away he went with a parting shot about goddamn ill-natured unforgiving shrews that went home. And she's been crying her eyes out ever since. Poor soul, poor soul. And it was an ill-fated marriage. She's never taken pleasure in the act itself. She's always dreaded pregnancies, and her deliveries have been extremely painful. It's long seemed to me that jealousy and frigidity, or at least tepidness, are in direct proportion to one another. And Jack is what is ordinarily called a very full-blooded man. I dare say you're right about frigidity and jealousy, but I believe you're wrong in calling Sophie frigid. Certainly when her mother's by, I think she'd be a poor companion for a lively, eager man. Indeed, Jack would never have got her into his bed at all if she hadn't run away in a ship far from her mother's eye. And then again, I have it on the best authority that Jack is no artist in these matters. He can board and carry an enemy frigate with guns roaring and drums beating in a couple of minutes, but that's no way to give a girl much pleasure. In better hands, she would, I'm sure, have been a very likely young woman. And oh, so much happier. Clearly you know more about these things than I. She has a lovely body still, in spite of these children, said Diana. But what is the use of a lovely body if neither you nor anyone else enjoys it? Sure, it is a great waste. The greatest shame of the world. Clarissa, who knows a great deal about the subject, and I... But, Lord, I've left out a most important part. I never told you that Aunt Williams has gone back to Bath. Mrs. Morris's fellow turned out to have several wives already, and he's been taken up for bigamy, false pretences, personation, forgery, theft, and God knows what, a right wrong un. And Aunt Williams is to be the prime witness for the prosecution. She's so proud and important. Swears she'll never leave till the man is hanged and she and her friend will end their days together. I bought them a little place just off the Paragon. Barham Down sold, then? How clever of you. No, that's another thing I was forgetting. After you'd been gone a while, I began to think it was just goddamn silly to squabble along on 200 a year when you have an enormous great diamond like the Blue Peter. I happened to mention it to Chumley. I still had his coach until a little while ago, and he agreed it was great nonsense. Why did I not borrow 50,000 or so until our affairs were settled? He could easily arrange it in the city, so I said yes. And now I'm absolutely swimming in money. Do let me give you some money, Stephen, dear. Sweetheart, honey, your kindness itself. But our affairs are already settled. They're just as they were, or even somewhat better. My loss of the receipt didn't signify, and I shall unpawn your bauble tomorrow. Now I come to think of it, he went on, stalking like Adam across the room to his brown paper parcel, here is a present to go with the jewel. He unwrapped a swathe of Lyon silk velvet, blacker than the darkest night. After several shrieks of rapture, she thanked him very prettily, congratulated him on his brilliant conduct in putting their affairs in order. She'd always been sure that he could do it, however complicated. Wrapped wrapped a fold or so about her pure white torso, and having collected her thoughts, she went on, "You wouldn't believe the difference in Sophie with her mother gone. For some time, Clarissa and I had been trying to comfort her, trying to make her understand that men, and most women, see these things quite differently. That for a man to leap into a welcoming bed doesn't mean treason, felony, or real serious unfaithfulness at all. She scarcely minded what we said, but once it was known that Aunt Williams was settled in Bath with Mrs. Morris, busy buying chintz and swearing affidavits, Sophie listened much, much more attentively.
How I wish I'd heard you.
You'd have learned a good deal, I believe.
That's what I mean. Little notion, very little notion, do I possess of the way women talk among themselves, above all on such matters.
And we went on about the very intense delight there is, or ought to be, in love-making. I said it was an absolute duty to enjoy it and to give as much pleasure in return as ever one could, that the pleasure was infectious. Clarissa spoke, and spoke very much more delicately than I did, quoting some Latin author about the way men like their partners to behave. And poor Sophie looked absolutely blank, muttering she thought you just lay there and let it happen. Oh, we said so many things. I made one rather good remark, or so it seemed to me at the time. A man does like some mark of appreciation of his efforts, you know. Then I said, but in a tone I thought she'd understand, that what she most urgently needed was a really kind, gentle and considerate lover to put her in tune and show her what all the talk and poetry and music and fine clothes were really about and how it justified them all. A man like Captain Adeen, who danced with her at all the last Dorchester assemblies and who was so discreetly particular. Do you know him, my dear?
I believe not.
He's a soldier, and he has a big place behind Colton, kept for him by a rather young and skittish aunt. Being so absurdly handsome, he's usually called Captain Apollo. He'll have nothing whatsoever to do with girls, but the young married women of the neighbourhood, well, I'll not say that they actually stand there in lines, but I believe he is a fairly general consolation. He gave a splendid ball last week.
I should like to meet the gentleman.
Oh, and another thing, we told her, perhaps the most important of all, we both insisted upon it much, was that there was nothing, nothing so bad for you or for your looks as self-righteousness. Nothing so wholly unamiable and souring as that habitual put-upon expression of discontent and implied reproach. The only thing to do, if you knew your lover or husband or whatever was being unfaithful, was to pay him back in his own coin. Not out of wantonness or revenge, but to avoid worse, to avoid self-righteousness. For having done that, you could never be a martyr again or put on a martyr's horrid face. She cried, shame on us for saying such dreadful things. We were really quite immoral and she was ashamed for us. But she didn't sound very convincing. And she didn't hurry away either. And presently she said, yes, that was all very well, but what about babies? People really couldn't keep having babies right and left. Of course not, we said. Did she really think that babies were inevitable? Yes, said she. That was what she'd always understood. So we told her, and I must say Clarissa was amazingly well informed, though she did say that trusting to the moon, to the calendar alone, was not absolutely safe. Dear Clarissa, I believe I saw her riding this morning a great way off. Yes, she's a very tolerable horsewoman now. She took the children out at break of day. They have little Connemara ponies, very sweet-mannered. Oh, Stephen, I must show you my Arabs! But there is one thing that worries me. Throw me my drawers, will you? Sophie breakfasts at 9, and she's sure to ask us. And it is that we might just possibly have overdone things. That she might have taken me literally. Sophie does tend to take things literally. But anyhow, he joins his regiment in Madras next week, so... "Stephen, dear, how very splendid you look," cried Sophie, embracing him.
"Ain't I the beauty of the world," said he, spreading the arms of his fine new coat and advancing one leg of his satin breeches. "Lewd seamen belonging to other ships took to calling old Clo, any old Clo, like ragpickers when I was rowed by, and it did so grieve the poor Bellonas. From the captain to the humblest ship's boy, not a week from the Marine Society's depot. So I have turned myself out like a peacock in all his glory, or like a whole screeching of peacocks." While he was talking in this airy, somewhat disconcerted manner, his grave eye told him that the beauty of the world, in fact, stood there before him, tall, straight, and in the very height of her charming bloom. A hand plucked his coat. Turning and looking down, he saw pink Bridget beaming up, with the promise of as much beauty and even more. "Dear, dear Papa," she said, "how very, very happy I am to see you. I've breeches for riding, you see, and I wouldn't lose a minute changing them. May I sit next to you?" Charlotte and Fanny came and made their bobs, looking stupid and awkward. George bade him welcome with an open, happy smile, very like his father's. Stephen kissed his old friend Clarissa, and with Bridget on his other side, he sat down by Sophie. "You've not just come back from Bellona?" she asked.
"Not at all. I've been in London and elsewhere this age."
"When did you last see Jack?"
"No memory for dates have I, but it was a great while since."
"Had he not had any letters from me?"
"He had not. We all complained most bitterly of the want of post. Yet apart from that, he was looking well and cheerful, extremely busy with his patrolling and working up the ship's company. I hope to see him even better in a day or two's time when I rejoin. I hear he's taken a splendid prize."
"We had so hoped you'd stay for Christmas," she cried.
"No, my dear honey, I only paused in my flight to see you all. At 11 o'clock a post chaise from Dorchester is coming to take me to Torbay by way of a village whose name escapes me."
"Nonsense," said Diana. "I shall drive you down as I drove you down before, but this time in our own coach. Sophie, forgive me, I must have the horses readied and put on some decent clothes."
She vanished.
"Oh, I shall come, I shall come, I shall come in the box," cried Bridget, bouncing as she sat.
"No, you shall not, my dear," said Stephen. "Never in life."
"Certainly not," said Sophie. "There's the dancing master and Miss Hay."
"I shall ask Mama," said Bridget,
and at the door,
"I shall certainly go."
"Never in life," he'd said. And no gentle wheedling in Irish, no tears would move him. Added to this, there was the monstrous injustice that Padeen, the great traitor, was going, standing up behind in a fine livery coat. And with Diana gone, Sophie was obliged to say, "Dear Bridget, how sad it would be if your father's last sight of you was tears and an angry, slobbered face. Run away and put yourself in order. Brush your hair and find a new handkerchief."
"Stephen, I'm just going to scribble a couple of lines to Jack. Please will you give them to him with my dear, dear love?"
She hurried away to her desk, a little satinwood bonheur du jour that had belonged to Jack's mother, and after some hesitation she wrote,
"Dear Jack, may I beg for forgiveness? Oh, how I hope you are a better-natured creature than I was. Love, S." She sealed it, not without misgivings about its want of style, dignity, possibly of correctness, and ran back to the steps, where everyone was already gazing at the fine, dark-green coach with Diana on the box, Stephen beside her, Padeen up behind, and grooms holding the horses' heads. Sophie handed up the note. Stephen leaned down and kissed her.
"Let go," cried Diana, gathering the reins.
With the coach in motion, Stephen looked back. And indeed, his last sight of his daughter was a rain-washed but fairly cheerful face and a clean white handkerchief waving frantically. They were silent for a while, with Diana addressing the horses from time to time, individually or as a team. They were Cleveland Bays, well-matched, usually well-mannered, but now a trifle apt to caper, particularly in the village, where people called out greetings, sometimes running alongside to send their duty and dear love and respects to the captain, and some waving sheets or the like from upper windows. Presently, however, they were on the high road, climbing to the top of the down that overlooked Woolcombe Valley, pulling well and all together. Just enough frost to whiten the grass now on the road itself, and the horse's breath a glorious cloud. "How wonderfully smooth it is, this fine green machine," said Stephen. "Yes," said Diana. "Handley's made it, and they told me about the new kind of springs they put in. Long strips of the best Swedish steel, overlapping and sliding upon one another, and cased in leather, and fastened to the body by pivoting brass." When she'd finished a pretty detailed account of the coach's building, which she'd followed with the closest interest, and of the innumerable coats of paint and then a varnish that had been laid on, together with the history of her visit, guided by the invaluable Mr. Thomas Handley to the wheelwright shop, where, among other wonders, she saw the shrinking on of a tyre, she said, "You would have loved it." "I'm very certain that I should," he replied. And after a decent pause, "Please, may I beg you to relieve my mind?" "Of course you may, dear Stephen," she said, with an affectionate sideways glance, and much, much louder. "Norman, you goddamn bastard, bear out, you hear me?" Norman heard both her emphatic voice and the crack of her whip, not 6 inches from his ear, and at once ceased boring into his neighbour, an irritating trick he often displayed early in a run. "I say this because Bridget is a shatter-brained little creature, as quick as a trout. She was once off my saddle-bow and into a pile of filth one day on the common, soft filth, although I had a hand on her shoulder. She'd seen a baby rabbit. So, in pure compliment to me, swear and promise and pledge yourself never to let her onto the box of a coach so tall and the road so hard, purely and simply in compliment to me and my superstitions." "Very well, my dear," she said in the kindest way, "and here's my hand upon it," patting him quickly. Now they were on the flat. A broad road with woodland on the left and not a soul upon it. The horses were supplied and warm, eager to run. She encouraged them, leaning forward, calling them by name, whistling, and the smooth coach fairly raced along for 2 blissful miles before she reined in laughing at the foot of the next hill with a series of turns in a high-perched village. "This is what coaching should be," he said, when they were through and on the open, uncrowded road again. "The weather is perfect, and you, my dear, are the delicate whip of the world." On and on, the hedges flying past, and they baiting where they'd baited before, navigating the devilish bridge in its corner of Maiden Ascot with an almost insolent ease. And they slept at the comfortable inn where they'd slept last time. Here, as the horses were being walked up and down, Stephen talked at length to Padine about the small farm in the County Clare that had so enraptured him when Stephen promised it as a reward for looking after Bridget and Clarissa in Spain. A rapture that had waxed and waned. It still retained a theoretical existence, but perhaps little more. From this conversation in the twilight, the longest they'd had for a great while, a conversation full of the turns and evasions of an Irish person who wishes to say something delicately defined, but who would like to do so without giving any hint of offence, Stephen came away with a variety of notions. Did Padine feel that a wife was an absolutely necessary part of a farm, and did he dread marriage? Was he afraid of being unable to run the holding, having been so long away from the land? Had so many years of servitude done away with his independence? As he sat on an ancient cane-bottomed chair in their chamber, mechanically arranging the horsehair curls of his wig, a wilder fancy came into his mind. Was the poor soul consumed by hopeless passion for Clarissa Oakes? Although it wasn't very, very much more remote from possibility than his own for Diana, he shook his head and determined to say no more, other than suggesting a tenant to keep the land clean and in heart. "Are you never coming to bed?" she called. "The candle's guttering dreadfully." The next day was a much shorter run, and they did it in splendid time, the weather more perfectly late autumn than ever, the horses obviously enjoying themselves, except when Mangold cast a shoe, and all hands stood in all about the nearest smithy, surrounded by smoke, the wheeze of the bellows, the flying sparks, and the scent of his well-pared hoof. Before noon, they were on the Torquay Strand, gazing out over the bay at the men-of-war. At this time there was no tedious to-and-froing, no mounting anxiety. They'd not been there 5 minutes before Stephen, hearing the cry, "Dr. Maturin!" looked round straight into the smiling face of Philip Aubrey, Jack's much younger half-brother, now in charge of a boat belonging to the Swallow, an aviso bound for the offshore squadron from which Stephen could easily reach the Bellona. The offer couldn't be refused, but they parted reluctantly like lovers, unwilling, forced and constrained, regretting the fair breeze that carried the boat out, out and away. Philip and Stephen couldn't speak freely until the boat reached the aviso, but there Philip commanded a private, roughly triangular space with just room for two, and here, while they regaled on fresh bread and cheese, Philip said, "I don't like to sound holier than thou, nor to speak disrespectfully of my elders, but I must say that poor Jack's mother-in-law does come it pretty high. George, he's my nephew, you know, though I can't make either him or the girls call me uncle, has just started going to that mouldy little school between Folly and Plush run by our parson's brother. Well, the first day he went there, the other boys asked him what his father was. 'My father is a sea officer,' said George. Then, drawing himself up, he went on, 'and an adulterer.' 'How do you know?' they asked. 'My grandmama told me and the girls,' said George. I laughed at first. You know how George swells when he's proud. But then I thought it was a miserable goddamn thing to tell children. Don't you agree, sir?"
"Mrs. Williams is no blood relation of yours, I believe."
"No, sir. My grandfather, the General, married again after Jack's mother died. She was called Stanhope. And I come from the second marriage, so when Jack married Sophie Williams, that didn't make her mother any relation of mine."
"Then in that case, I will tell you that in my considered opinion, she is a perfectly odious woman." As though struck down by a judgment the moment he'd finished these words, he pitched forward out of his chair onto what little deck was free. Philip plucked him up and raced onto the deck, which had been left in charge of an even younger midshipman, who in the pride of his heart had committed the vessel to a manoeuvre that, the guys being untimely cast off, resulted in a truly monumental jibe. The aviso didn't quite overturn, but the tangle of parted cordage, the sprung boom and the horrid condition of the bowsprit and its gammoning kept the captain, a master's mate, Philip and his companions, happily there were some prime seamen among them, busy most of the rest of the day and of the fine, moonlit night. The aviso was, at least, presentable when she raised the topsails of the offshore squadron a little after breakfast. A much enlarged offshore squadron, with at least three more ships of the line, as well as frigates, sloops and gun brigs. And Philip, though pale and drawn, could have passed a not very rigorous muster when he went aboard the Queen Charlotte with Stephen. His last words, in a whisper rendered hoarse by extreme fatigue, were, "You won't tell Jack, sir, I beg." On seeing Dr. Maturin, the officer of the watch sent word to the first lieutenant, who asked Stephen to come and see Sherman, the flagship surgeon, in his cabin. "Dr. Maturin, sir, how good of you to come," said Mr. Sherman. "My assistants and I are deeply concerned about the Admiral, who's often mentioned you, hoping for your return to the squadron.
and I should be very much obliged for your opinion. He's now so weak that I don't think he could stand going home aboard a small vessel in the gales we're certain to have at this season of the year, and he absolutely refuses to detach a capital ship. I should be happy to see him, said Stephen.
Dr. Maturin, how happy I am to see you, said Lord Stranraer, half rising in his cot. Many is the day I have hoped you might return to the squadron.
Stephen looked at him with a keen, wholly objective eye, and saw a hag-ridden old man, sick, and like so many patients, dreading the immediate future. A dropsical tendency, in spite of some degree of physical collapse, a very, very rapid and irregular pulse, as Sherman had said, though it was clear that the Admiral had no opinion of what Sherman had said, and probably an exaggerated notion of Maturin's powers. "Pray take off your shirt, my lord," he said, and helped him to do so. To Mr. Sherman, "Be so good as to ask the officer of the watch to stop any running about on deck. Let there be no thumps." A relative silence ensued, and Stephen set about an intensive auscultation of Stranraer's chest, tapping like a woodpecker, watched by Sherman with barely concealed astonishment. Straightening up at last and covering the Admiral with the bedclothes, he said, "This is grave, of course, as you know very well. But I think it looks and feels worse than in fact it is. I shall consult with Mr. Sherman and his colleagues and look over the ship's dispensary, and I believe we shall agree upon a course of physic, of natural forms of physic, that will give you relief." The Admiral took his hand, and with a look of affectionate regard on a face not accustomed to show affection, thanked him for his care. "Clearly," said Stephen, when he and the surgeons were in the captain's cabin and drinking the captain's Madeira, "the trouble lies essentially with the heart. There's a not inconsiderable hydropericardium, and of course with the mind, as is almost invariably the case where anything but wounds or infections are concerned. First, we must reduce this frantic pulse and recall the heart to its duty. What does he take at present?" Sherman mentioned a low diet and a few harmless substances and went on, "But I'm sorry to say that we don't enjoy the patient's full confidence. And I have reason to believe that most of our drafts end in the closed stool. It's difficult to discipline an admiral who's also a peer. May I ask you about the edema that you spoke of? It's not at all apparent, or at least not to me. Auscultation shows it clearly enough, once I'd grown accustomed to his particular bodily sounds. It's a very valuable diagnostic tool, little known in England, I believe. I've never seen it done. A friend of mine in France called Corvisal has made great progress with the immediate percussion that I was using. Postmortems have provided a most gratifying confirmation of many of his diagnoses, and another French friend with whom I studied, Leyenac, is carrying the method still further. I heard him lecture in Paris during the piece," said one of the assistant surgeons, speaking for the first time. "But since he used the continental pronunciation, I couldn't follow his Latin very well. For the pulse, I should advise digitalis purpurea," said Stephen. "Does your chest contain either the tincture or the infusion?" "Neither," replied Sherman. "After two most unfortunate experiences, I declined the use of digitalis altogether as too dangerous by far. My predecessor, however, left a sealed jar of the dried leaves. They will answer very well. In the Admiral's case, I should exhibit 1 grain and a quarter enclosed in a wafer. And if you think fit, I will administer it myself, together with 25 minims of laudanum. You'll not find the pulse diminish sensibly before Thursday evening, but the laudanum will quickly produce a better frame of mind, a readier compliance with medical direction, or perhaps in the case of an Admiral, I should say, advice. If the first dose of powdered leaves is well tolerated, if there's no severe vomiting or seeing everything blue, which I don't expect at all, it may be repeated, together with the laudanum, at 2-day intervals. And if it's at all possible, I should like to be informed of his progress. Now, if you agree, I will ask the young gentleman to put up the doses so that I may administer them directly, for I have patients of my own waiting for me aboard the Bellona. Sir, said the other assistant surgeon, with an evident satisfaction that the powerful drug was now to be used and he a witness to its effects. I've read Dr. Withering on Digitalis, and I shall take great pleasure in powdering the leaves exactly to his direction. The flagship's cutter came upon the Bellona, off the Black Rocks, lying to with her foretopsail to the mast, and her driver just drawing while her captain made a final check of the wreck's depth and bearings. His grim, mathematical face broke into a smile. As soon as the boats were in hail, he called, "Welcome home, Doctor! You'll be just in time for dinner." And when they were aboard with Stephen Seachest and small baggage below and proper greetings made, "Which you look prime, sir," said Killick, looking really quite agreeable, almost as if you'd been to the Lord Mayor's show, while Bondon told him that his head was quite healed, could be hit with a top maul and never a word, and himself lively as a parcel of Griggs. And this with no hint of that somewhat slurred familiarity that had grieved Stephen earlier with its suspicion of mental damage. Jack told him that Captain Fanshawe was coming to dinner, so that he, Stephen, was in great luck, since he could have his share of the last shoulder of mutton in the ship, probably in the whole inshore squadron. "I'm so glad you're here to carve it," he went on, sitting down and pouring them some sherry. "There's no worse joint to tackle in public. But tell me, Stephen, how'd you do? And how's Diana, if you've seen her again? You look extremely fine, by the way." They'd both changed for the ceremony. "Why, I'm extremely rich again, and the two tend to go together, you know. I believe I told you that I had mislaid my fortune, but apparently my negligence didn't signify. All is well now, and vast wealth improves a man's looks amazingly. So does an eminent London tailor. She's uncommonly well, I thank you, and so is Bridget. They both send their love, and I am charged with this," drawing a letter from his pocket, "with Sophie's dear love as well." Jack's face changed. "Did she say that?" he asked sternly. "I believe those were her very words. Or perhaps, dear, dear love." Jack took the letter, muttered, "Forgive me," and retired. He came back after a while, taller, straighter, his face glistening. "Dear Lord, Stephen," he cried, "that was the best letter I've ever received. Thank you very, very much." He shook Stephen's hand, looking down on him with infinite benevolence. "And admirably well wrote, too. Such a delicate hand." He gazed about in a confusion of happiness, then plucked his fiddle from its case, tuned it, more or less. It had laid long, untouched, and dashed off a truly astonishing trill, interrupted by the boatswain's calls as Captain Fanshawe was piped aboard. "I do beg your pardon, Jack," he cried, making his entrance. "I'm abominably late. The current set northeast like a goddamn mill race, and we had to pull against the tide as well. Never mind, Billy, never mind. Even I miscalculate at times. Drink some sherry and recover your breath. You know Dr. Maturin, I believe?" "Of course I do. We're old friends. How do you do, sir? It's a great while since I've had the pleasure of seeing you." Harding came in at this point, and Killick just behind him, to ask, with half a disapproving eye on Captain Fanshawe, whether his honour would choose to have the soup held back still longer, or whether it might be set on table now. It was set on table. A lobster bisque, the one delight of these bleak rock-strewn waters, with the guests gathered round it, and presently Fanshawe, pushing his third plate away from him, said, "Well, Jack, you and your people look wonderfully rich and happy and comfortable. I don't wonder at it with such a prize under your belt and a kindly commissioner of dock. But tell me, did the yards serve out any slops?" "Not so much as a tarpaulin jacket," said Jack. "I had no money by me, the prize not having been condemned, so there was no question of the customary presents here and there. And then again, I was much engaged in the country at the time, And although the Commissioner was wonderfully good to me where cordage and spars were concerned, and the powder hoy, the bloody-minded victuallers were shocking remiss. And since I was in such a tearing hurry to get to sea, I didn't stir them up, but relied on their coming out to the squadron. "There you may wait until we're ground on our own beef bones," said Fanshawe. "In Ramillies we're down to a few casks of bread, some weevily oatmeal, and what we can catch over the side. No poultry left, pigs a remote dream, precious few rats to be had under fourpence apiece. But as for slops, why, the purser told me but yesterday, with tears in his eyes, that we had no jackets, no blankets, and no slop shoes at all. This with winter coming on. The last storeship was beaten back into Corsan Bay, so nothing till next month. Can you spare us any? Even a couple of blankets for the sick berth would be welcome." "I shall ask my purser," said Jack, looking eagerly at the mutton, just coming in with a certain pomp mutton, welcome, very welcome in itself, and because it might change the course of Fanshawe's dreary conversation. The shoulder, though succulent and expertly carved, didn't do so at first. "No stores and no news," said Fanshawe. "The last we had was a great while ago, when Austria declared on our side. But Boney'd thrashed the Austrians again and again, and he'll certainly beat them this time, too. Wellington sits there on the Garonne, the land of Goshen, no doubt, instead of marching north. So the French ships of the line in Rochefort, La Rochelle, and even Lorient can lure the offshore squadron westwards and combine with those here in Brest to cut us to pieces. Not that a battle would be much out of the way, with the Admiral so far out of sight of Ushant it's impossible for us to prevent the French getting in with a west wind by either of the two main entrances. We take great pains, as you know damn well, and an anxious time we have of it, what with tides and rocks. More danger in this station than a battle once a week."
"Allow me to carve you a slice of mutton, sir," said Stephen.
"Well, if I must, I must. Thank you. It's truly capital mutton, perfectly hung. Now, I'll just quote you a piece from a letter I wrote to my poor wife, and then finish my dirge, apart from throwing out the remark that we don't possess a single second topsail among us all. Here's my piece. I therefore bid adieu to snug beds and comfortable naps at night, never lying down but in my clothes. We hear no news here, and cannot be in more seclusion from the world, and with one object in view, that of preventing the French from doing harm. There, I've done." "A glass of wine with you, Billy," said Jack, and the decanter went round and round again. Then the claret was replaced by port, and after the first glass, Stephen rose, begged Jack's pardon, but he'd promised to see his patients at six bells, and he'd just heard them strike. "Mr. Smith and Mr. Macaulay," he asked far below, "how do you do, the both of you? I'm happy to see you so apparently well." They were well, they admitted, though hungry. The berth had eaten all their private stock, and now they were down to ship's provisions. But they were afraid he wouldn't be so pleased with the sick berth, nor with the medicine chest. The run ashore at dock had produced such a number of cases of pox that the berth was overfilled, and the chest almost bare of venereal medicines. They had also to add that in the last storm but one, three men had been washed bodily off the forecastle, and that in the effort to get some sail on the ship to prevent her rolling her masts out, they had four broken limbs and some ugly dislocations, mostly reduced by now, but with some disquieting sequelae. Before beginning his round, Stephen asked, "How is Bondon, the captain's coxswain?" "The man with the wing?" "Oh, quite well, sir, though I believe he asked for a purge some time ago. Yes, I gave him rhubarb, ounce and a half, and it answered. Please let him know I should like to see him when it's his watch below." Eight bells, and with the usual sound of a great wooden hollow rumbling, some hundreds of men hurried to and from their appointed places. Bondon was pinned and led to the dispensary, looking anxious. "Oh, it's you again, sir," he cried, smiling as he saw Stephen. "I didn't have time just now to ask after the ladies. I hope you left them well."
Very well indeed, thank you, Bondon. And they send their kindest wishes. Now, I should just like to look at your head. The head, now covered with stubble, was indeed fit to be struck with a top maul. The scars could be made out, but there was nothing of that yielding either side of the sagittal suture, and a little above the lambdoid that had worried Dr. Maturin. There, he said, replacing the seaman-like wig. In my opinion, you are as good as new, I shall tell the captain. He was much concerned for you. I know he was, sir. Kept me from work as much as ever he could. But you know, sir, Killick and me, we're much concerned for him, if I may be so bold. Stephen nodded and said, "You may find him better presently." In point of fact, he was better already. Very much better, recovered from his first almost painful ebullience, and sitting there in the evening cabin with deadlight shipped and the Bellona snugged down, a moderate roll and a southwest breeze with a fine steady glass for once, he was perfectly ready to listen with close attention to Stephen's account of Woolcombe. "I'm heartily glad that Mrs. Williams has gone back to Bath to live there with her friend," he said. "Sophie was never the same with her in the place. And I must say it was amazingly handsome in Diana to give them the little house." "Dear Diana, she's in funds again. So am I, as I told you. And for my part, I'm not quite the abject bankrupt pauper I was. The lawyers sent me some reports that would have sent me to the masthead if Sophie's letter hadn't arrived just before them. Two of our appeals have succeeded, and Lawrence, that dear good man, says he's virtually certain of winning the third and last. And my share of this last prize should just about set me afloat again, in a very modest fashion. From all I hear, it was a splendid prize. I give you joy of her brother with all my heart." "Thank you, Stephen. She was indeed rather in the style of the Frenchman we took off the Dry Tortugas, Hebe, formerly our hyena, you remember. She'd taken an English guineaman and her lovely cargo of gold dust and ivory, except that the Der Frere, this most recent prize, had taken two guineamen, each of them larger and richer than that dear old intrepid fox." Stephen nodded gravely. "I'm sure you pursued her with all the zeal in the world." "So I did, by God. But with no real thought of prize money, certainly not prize money to that staggering extent. No, I saw her chasing one of our merchantmen already within long shot. I was fairly spoiling for a fight. It was the fight I was after, and it was the fight I cracked on for, and the plain call of duty too, of course. It has been reported that you broke away from manoeuvres and chased from a desire for gain." "That was an untrue report. The weather was thick and growing thicker. Signals were barely visible. I had to act quickly or not at all, and I may not have been strictly correct in acknowledging, but I certainly did say I was chasing nor'west before the rest of the squadron disappeared from sight. And, in fact, I did take a dangerous enemy privateer, and I preserved a British merchantman. That was my aim. The money, though uncommon welcome to all hands, had nothing whatsoever to do with it. It was neither here nor there." A pause. "No," Jack went on, "I was brought up to think that making money was a very proper thing to do, the proper something of mankind. Pursuit, perhaps. The proper pursuit. My father didn't have a great deal of time to improve my morals, but now and then he used to urge me to take notice of various precepts of a religious nature. He was at Eton, you know. That large school near Windsor." "Just so. A sad place, I fear. I was there with a friend. We'd meant to view the castle, but on reaching a place called Salt Hill, we were beset, surrounded by a host of boys and youths dressed as Jack Puddings and Merry Andrews in antique garments who insisted upon arms. Sturdy, threatening beggars. We'd little between us, and they gave us very ill language indeed, before going on to some unfortunate newcomers in a gig. Yet it is true that I've heard they possess a store of Greek between them. I dare say they have. But it's almost the only Latin that my father learnt, and the text he always quoted to me was, 'Rem facias, rem si possis recte si non, quocumque modo rem.' Just where it was in the Bible, I'm not sure. My father thought it was one of the minor prophets. It often occurs to me when I'm shaving or when church is being rigged.
but it was not in my mind at all. Not for a moment when I was chasing the Durfrere, though it would have been appropriate in a way, and perhaps even lucky. Sometimes I think I ought to hand it on to George. When all's said and done, a Latin text is something for a boy to possess. Dear Jack, I'm sorry to contradict your father. Probably some wicked schoolfellow made game of him, but it is Horace, not the Bible. And Mr. Pope renders it very well. Get place and wealth, if possible, with grace. If not, by any means get wealth and place. And you would never wish that upon your good, open-faced little fat boy's ancestral wisdom, sure. But this brings me to my conversation with Sir Joseph Blaine. I conceive that you wouldn't take it amiss if I were to talk to him about you. Never in life, never in life, upon my word. I have the greatest possible respect and esteem for Sir Joseph. He's been very much my friend. I owe my reinstatement largely to him. Of course you could talk to Sir Joseph Blaine. I talked to him about your prospects of a flag. He told me that they were not what he and your other friends could wish. He said that your repeated and vehement criticism of the ministry in Parliament, together with your frequent abstentions, had done you much harm in government's opinion, and reports of negligence on the Brest station, together with abandoning manoeuvres to indulge in very highly profitable chasing, had done the same in that of the Admiralty. He explained the capital importance of Lord Stranraer's friends and dependents in the Commons. Stephen recapitulated Blaine's analysis and went on. Sir Joseph felt that your friends might be well advised to urge you to retire as a post-captain, rather than expose yourself to the affront of being passed over at a forthcoming flag promotion. He is, as you say, very much your friend, and he did throw out some confused remarks about the possibility of a commissionership or even some civilian employment, conceivably to do with hydrography. A silence fell. A silence of voices. The steady heave of the sea carried on, barely perceptible unless one paid attention, and the countless sounds of mast yards rigging, and the current round the rudder. But then an impact, curiously prolonged. That would be a whale scraping his side, observed Jack. Stephen nodded and went on. I then raised another point. As you know, I was in France, and there I met some of the men I had known in South America when we were concerned with Peruvian independence. But these gentlemen were from Valparaiso in Chile. They are as ambitious of independence from Spain as were the Peruvians, and in my opinion they are more reliable. And the Chileans are much more concerned with the naval side of the matter than the Peruvians. Sir Joseph put all this to the proper authorities, and in their guarded way they expressed themselves as willing to give unacknowledged, unofficial support and comfort to the movement. You're very much in favour of independence, said Jack. I've often noticed it. You too might think more highly of the state had you been dependent. I'm sure I should. I beg pardon. Please go on. What I have to say now is very much up in the air, quite hypothetical. But there is a possibility that this war may come to an end quite soon. It's likely to be followed by a period of confusion, possibly a change of ministry, certainly a vast paying off of ships and very widespread unemployment in the Navy. Alas, it is but too true. Now, suppose that during this period you were withdrawn from the list and from the competition, being employed in Chilean waters, ostensibly and no doubt actually surveying, distinguishing yourself in various ways, behaving much as you did aboard the Surprise not so long since, in a temporary, nominally retired condition, reinstatement being promised together with the probability of a blue flag in due course, a rear admiral's flag. How would that suit you?
Sir Joseph and Lord Melville think that from the service point of view it could be arranged.
Lord Stephen, it's a most prodigious attractive prospect.
He considered for some minutes.
To be out of the hurly-burly for a while,
he muttered. And then...
You did say Stranraer's influence was the strongest thing against me, and that if he died his influence would no longer be there, wouldn't pass to Griffiths.
Stephen nodded.
They say he's very poorly indeed. Is he likely to live, do you think?
Jesus, Mary and Joseph, cried Stephen, starting up. Do you ask me to discuss a patient, sir? Be damned to your impertinence. You would be desiring me to give him a quietus next.
Oh, pray don't be angry, Stephen. I didn't mean to ask you as a medico. I only threw it out like that, talking in my sleep. Sit down again, I beg. It was a most scrub-like thing to say even silently, and I do apologise without the least reserve. Yours is a beautiful idea. I like it of all things, and I'm infinitely obliged to you and Sir Joseph. Pray let me fill your glass. They sat reflecting.
And when Jack had filled their glasses yet again, he said timidly,
It would be the most beautiful idea in the world, but for that wretched probability. The probability of a flag.